Hello and welcome to The Graveyard Shift, the weekly horror podcast where we take listener and guest suggestions and break them down into the good, the bad, and anything else we find fun and or relevant. My name is Mike, and I never work The Graveyard Shift alone. Please welcome the guy who was the last podcast co-host standing, John.
Yes, there could be only one, and maybe a few others too.
It was a long, brutal battle, but John emerged victorious.
Yeah, right.
At least in maybe, stage one.
Right. Maybe I'm just the only one just laying around. It's like, it's like I have no life.
It's like everyone else called in sick for the deathmatch, so I guess he won by default.
Yeah, right.
He's the only one that showed up.
Yep. It's like, hey, man, I heard there was going to be a free t-shirt, so... All right.
So, but, hey, yeah. Today's episode is Extreme Downsizing, because we watched the Belko Experiment. This was directed by Greg McLean, written by James Gunn, produced by Peter Safran and James Gunn, with cinematography by Louis David Sanzis, edited by Julia Wong, music by Tyler Bates, produced by Troll Court Entertainment, The Safran Company, and Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. This was distributed by Orion Pictures and Blumhouse Tilt. This was released September 10th, 2016 at the Toronto International Film Festival and then in the rest of the United States on March 17th, 2017. This has a runtime of 89 minutes with a budget of $5 million and a box office of $11.1 million.
Oh, good. So it made some money.
This has a Rotten Tomatoes score of 55%. I think that's a little unfair. I have a slightly higher opinion of this movie.
I felt that that's almost about how I would have rated it myself, though, to be honest. I don't know. It's got some good things, to, I think, to like about it. But I don't know. It felt a bit thin is what I would say.
This stars John Gallagher Jr. as Mike Milch, an employee at Belko Industries. Oh, wait, forgot the synopsis. Okay, the synopsis is a seemingly regular day at the office in a at a business of dubious nature in Bogota, where basically they're supposed to like help people acclimate. Do you remember what the concept was of their business?
It felt like they were, I guess, They were some like a call sort center. Of
it's some it's in some ways,
yeah. And they were doing some sort of like they were doing recruiting for people, like for companies over there trying to get American employees to work over there, like, you know, people in another country that are like trying to get Americans, I guess, to maybe deal business with American clients. So it's kind of the same way, like why maybe a country here, the U.S., would hire like. You know, foreign workers, foreign professionals who come in that, like, they speak another language or something like that.
So it's kind of like the inverse of a regular call center?
Yeah, at least that's how I, like, would kind of gathered it. It was, yeah, it was like a outsourcing program for, you know, U.S. employees.
Yeah, that was just weird.
But it was a little vague.
This company of, like we said, a dubious mission statement.
Right.
A seemingly regular day at the office turns into a death match when the entire building is closed off and an anonymous voice over the loudspeakers demands that the company employees kill each other. And when, of course, they don't, they realize that the voice holds all the cards as they start dropping like flies. So it's either kill the amount of people that they're told to, or double the amount will die.
Yep.
So, basically, it's like Office Space meets Battle Royale.
Yep, as the tagline, I guess, for it is. Yeah, it's a good way to think of it. It's kind of like if they just, you know, took it to its pathological extreme. You know, just like the corporate structure of Office Space. If it turned into a dark movie and then again, yeah, like take it to its like extremes.
Well,
the logical conclusion to this would be yeah, you guys are basically all minions. We don't, you don't mean shit. And so now we're just going to kill you.
Well, did you ever see the movie Mayhem?
No, I had not.
Okay. This is kind of like the movie that you're describing that you want.
Right.
Because it's a like a rabid zombie outbreak. Uh-huh. Except they're not entirely like rabid zombies. It's like a virus that just immensely ups your aggression. And it even leads to a law being passed that people who commit violence while infected by this are not deemed legally responsible for their actions.
Wow.
So when a viral outbreak takes place at the very law firm that found this loophole and got it passed, this guy Derek, played by John Cho, Stephen Young from The Walking Dead. He gets fired from this on the day that they have this massive outbreak. So he uses the outbreak as an excuse to finally get revenge on everyone that he's hated working with, who just basically fired him for no reason. Like, they basically lost some clients and some jobs and shit, but Someone's head had to roll. So He got pinned on everyone else's fuckery. So now he uses the outbreak as his justification to just work his way from the basement of the building to the penthouse where the board of executives are.
Uh-huh.
And it's basically like Office Space meets The Raid.
Right. Yeah, I was going to say it kind of reminds me of fucking The Purge meets 28 Days Later.
So it is, it's really fucking funny and good.
Yeah. Awesome. Mayhem is what it's called?
Yep.
Oh, nice. Well, shit. Yeah, that definitely sounds like something I would get a kick out of. I mean, the fucking Office Space is just one of my favorite movies in general.
So, John Gallagher Jr. plays Mike Milch, an employee at Belco Industries, the company of dubious nature. And then we have Todd Goldwyn as Barry Norris, the COO of Belco and an ex-Special Forces soldier. He was the voice of Disney's Tarzan.
Fun fact.
He's the grandson of Samuel Goldwyn of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer.
Huh. No shit, huh?
You know, funny enough, the first line didn't roar.
Yeah, Metro-Goldwyn, yeah, that production company. It didn't roar, huh?
No, the first one didn't.
Huh. It's just like sitting there, you know?
Yeah, the
first one. Yeah, I think I've seen that. I think I've seen that sequence. He's just sitting there, just looking all cute, chomping. He's just a lion. But, I don't know. I don't want to think about that era, though, of Hollywood, because I'm pretty sure those lions, like, horrible things happened to him, you know?
I looked up some of their stories, and there's entire articles talking about them, and it's interesting to see where these lions came from and what happened afterwards.
Right.
But the guy's name, it was some Yiddish thing, and eventually he changed it to Goldfish. And he moved, and like, the guy's name, like, he changed it to Goldwyn later, but his last name wasn't actually Goldwyn. It was more similar to Goldfish.
Oh. Huh.
But he teamed up with another guy like Selwyn or something. Mm-hmm. So they combined their names for their studio. So Gold and Win to make Goldwyn.
That's pretty amusing.
Oh, this guy had an amazing life. One of the first things he did was he teamed up with a bunch of his friends to create the Lasky Feature Play Company. And this was like, this produced The Squaw Man in 1914, and that was the first feature-length Hollywood film.
No shit.
Which clocked in at 73 minutes, and it was directed by Cecil B. DeMille. Yes, the producer and director of The Ten Commandments and other big spectacle movies.
Mm-hmm.
He was like this guy's buddy. Wow. And they teamed up to make the very first feature film Hollywood movie. And it featured an actual native person in a role. So there was a time when Hollywood did have some accuracy. Oh, wait, no. Because this character's father was played by a totally white dude named John Singleton. So they whitewashed even in the same movie where they had some authenticity.
Yep. He was the single man that could do this role. Only him, the Singleton.
It's like we can only afford to have one native person in a movie because we want to get some white people to watch this.
Yeah. Yeah, apparently so.
Yeah, so, what was that?
Oh, I would say, yeah, no, that was pretty cool, though. It's interesting.
And this also stars Adria Arona as Leandra Flores, Norris's assistant and Mike's love interest. John C. McGinley from Scrubs.
Yeah.
I think it's Scrubs, right?
Yep. Yeah.
As Wendell Dukes, a socially awkward top executive. Socially awkward. That's the polite way of saying rapist.
Yeah, no. I think McGinley is in no way, like, ever plays a role that I'd say is awkward. He's always, like, inappropriately aggressive.
Yeah, he's just got that face.
Yeah. Yeah, but I love him in Scrubs. He's one of my favorite characters. But, yeah, he could definitely play he always plays some form of, like, asshole. He's either, like, a really lovable asshole or he's just, like, in this particular one, he's just a repugnant asshole, you know?
And Melanie Diaz as Danny Wilkins, a new hire at Belco. Owen Yeoman as Terry Winters, Mike's co-worker and friend. Sean Gunn, yes, the brother of James Gunn, as Marty Espenscheid, a cafeteria worker. Who you may recognize from Guardians of the Galaxy. And a bunch of other James Gunn movies because nepotism.
Yep.
But he's honest. He's proud of his nepotism.
Yeah. I mean, we got Michael Rooker back in this, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, he's awesome.
Brent Sexton as Vince Agostino, Belco's head of human resources.
Mm-hmm.
Josh Brenner as Keith McClure, no relation to Troy McClure.
Yeah.
David Dalsmalchin as Alonzo Lonnie Crane, a maintenance worker under Melks. Oh, Michael Rooker as Bud Melks, Belco's head of maintenance. David Del Rio as Roberto Jerez, a worker who befriends Danny. Mm-hmm. Greg Henry as The Voice.
The Voice.
Rusty Schwimmer from Jason Goes to Hell. As Peggy Displasia, Milch's secretary. Gail Bean as Leota Hynek, a worker who befriends Wilkins. James Earl as Evan Smith, Belco's only security guard.
Mm-hmm.
Abraham Ben Ruby as Chet Valancourt, Espenchard's best friend. Valentin Miel as Ross Reynolds, a sales representative for Belco. Stephen Blackheart as Robert Hickland, an interpreter. Benjamin Byron Davis as Antonio Fowler, a worker. Sylvia De Dios as Helena Barton, the supervisor of Roberto, Leota, Bradley, and Danny. Cindy Better as Lorena Checo, a worker who pretends to be friendly to Norris. Andres Suarez as Bradley Lang, Danny's co-worker. Alieta Montero as Liaz Fremont, a cafeteria worker. Joe Freya as Tyson Moon, Wendell's girlfriend, and Michaela Hoover as Razia Mamarian, Agostino's assistant. And that's just, like, the big list of people who have, like, speaking roles. The actual cast list is fucking huge.
A ton of extras after that, you know. Guy 2.
Exploding fight. Head number 4.
Yeah. It'd just be like, Food Fight Girl 7. Some weird shit like that.
Girl hit in face with hot dog.
Yeah. You know, they call it the hot dog girl.
So, a little bit of trivia. I kept getting twisted by the name Belco because I heard it before. Mm-hmm. So, I tried looking up, like, where the fuck have I heard this before? And it turns out Belco is an auto body shop in Ottawa.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it does sound like the name of a country, or, a name of a company that actually exists.
Yeah, welcome to Belco Industries.
Belco.
get your car towed by Belko. And, and of course, James Gunn hiring so many people I know. The captain and co-captain of the Ravagers, or the Abductors of Star-Lord. We also got Greg Henry, who's been in some, who played Star-Lord's grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
So good to see them again. Of course, we got Michael Rooker. And the Polka Dot Man from Suicide Squad in this fucking movie working with Michael Rooker.
Yep. We got fucking Sean Gunn. We got, what is it? We got Rocket on here. Sean Gunn.
Yeah, the guy that, like, physically played Rocket.
Yeah.
We also got Keith, who does, like, the ant banter, or the ant-er. In the beginning of the movie with Rusty Schwimmer. He plays the voice of Mark Beeks, the Zuckerberg spoof on DuckTales.
Huh. Well, that's
if you cool. haven't seen the new DuckTales, it's fucking amazing.
Really?
Again, like this guy as the Mark Zuckerberg analog in Duckburg is absolutely perfect. Like he's a perfect representation of a tech douche.
Yeah, he looks like he could embody that character perfectly.
the new DuckTales, I can't speak enough sugar about this. It's excellent. It's got it references so much, like either from the original comics, the 87 movie. Of course, it brings back Darkwing Duck in an amazing new way. It's while acknowledging like the old TV show.
Yeah.
Which is freaking amazing. It even references the DuckTales video game.
Oh, awesome.
Because
my brother played a little bit of that.
Yeah, like one of the characters is stuck on the moon.
Yeah.
So it has a montage of them like coming up with ideas of trying to escape. And it's all done to the tune of the moon theme from DuckTales.
Oh, that's cool.
So as they're like assembling tribute, so. Yeah, they're assembling shit, and you hear like doo 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 doo. And the way they handle the mythology of all the characters, like even solving the mystery of Huey, Dewey, and Louie's mother.
Mm-hmm.
Like, who the fuck is she? Like, we always see them hanging out with their uncle Donald, but how is he their uncle?
Yeah.
And this actually explains how. I mean, Scrooge is voiced by fucking David Tennant, the 10th Doctor.
Oh shit.
It's just excellent. The way they handle Gizmo Duck is fantastic.
Yeah, apparently, like, man, some of these comebacks of these old shows are, like, better than the originals, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Like, or the at least they're sounding that way.
Oh, yeah, the way they handle Darkwing Duck.
Yeah.
And then they managed to, like, bring it back while acknowledging the old stuff and then, like, making new stuff. It's just fucking excellent.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, I don't remember much of Darkwing Duck back. I mean, that's been a long time since I've thought about that show. That's awesome.
Yeah, it's definitely worth checking out. Greg Henry was also in another office horror comedy called Office Uprising that came out in 2018 on Crackle. So if any of our two listeners who have Crackle is willing to give me their password, I will review this and give you a thank you in the opening of the episode. So about this movie, James Gunn began writing this film about 2007. So this is like a very old idea. And he got it after waking up from a dream of an office building being enclosed in metal walls and hearing a voice instructing the employees to kill each other. It got greenlit, and plans were made for it to be filmed in Sao Paulo, Brazil, with Gunn directing it. However, Gunn had to turn down the opportunity owing to getting a divorce at the same time. And he says, I just wanted to be around my friends and family. I didn't want to go shoot this thing, which is about people who loved and cared about each other being forced into killing each other. It didn't want to be the way I wanted to spend the next few months of my life. So I had to back out of it. And then he moved on to other film projects, including the 2010 film Super. And then he had just kind of forgot about it until he received a call from John Glickman at MGM asking if he would still be interested in making it. Gunn didn't have the time to direct the film himself, due to working on Guardians of the Galaxy, but he did agree to produce it, provided that he was given full creative control. And John Gallagher Jr., the lead role in this movie, had auditioned for a previous role, a previous film, directed by Gunn. He just wasn't right for that part. However, Gunn felt that his was one of the best auditions he had ever seen.
Yeah.
And he promised him that if he ever came up with another role for him, he would definitely get it.
That's cool.
Another bit of trivia, the body count on this movie, 84. 79 occupants of the building, plus the occupants of the hangar in the opposite end of the parking lot.
Yeah, this might be the biggest kill count out of any movie I've reviewed with you on here.
Well, how many... Well, we all know whenever we see a James Gunn movie, there's always going to be some slaughter scenes to some fucking kick-ass music.
Yes.
That's just his style. Even in Guardians of the Galaxy, like to the song, like, "Come a Little Bit Closer, You're My Kind of Man," while Michael Rooker just fucking murders a space station.
Yes. And, yeah, there's good use of, like, good use of soundtrack and stuff in this, like, this one particular one that's, like, really funny.
Oh, yeah. Even, like, fucking Suicide Squad, when Harley Quinn's tearing through the compound with her shotguns and baseball bats and shit, again, like, and then, like, it turns on, like, a big flower parade instead of blood.
Yeah.
So, yeah. James Gunn, he just fucking knows how to do violence and music together.
Yeah, and I think just to capture a mood, and it's like, it's always a little bit tongue-in-cheek about it, you know?
So, I mean, like, I think you can get, like, an inkling towards the range of my votes, but we haven't even got to the goods and the bads yet.
Yeah. So?
So, well, let's start with the goods, and we start with me. Fucking James Gunn loves killing Michael Rooker and Polka Dot Man.
Yeah, it sure does. And, you know, it's like particularly like, I figured Michael Rooker was going to die and stuff, but I was kind of surprised that he didn't, like, I was kind of thinking like, oh man, considering like, you know, Michael Rooker's filmography, like, this guy's going to end up being one of, like, the head, like, one of the most brutal killers, you know? Like, yeah, like, Michael Rooker's going to go real crazy, and he's going to be the more unhinged one, and then pretty much knew Barry was going to be, like, a bad guy, but he was going to be the more calm, controlled one, you know? But they're going to have kind of a standoff. But, no, he gets killed kind of early on in the movie.
Yeah, just like Suicide Squad.
Yep. Right. I don't know. I just, Michael Rooker that lately, he's been on my mind because I watched the movie Henry a few weeks ago, the Portrait of a Serial Killer. If you haven't seen that, that is...
I have not.
Dude, you need to see this movie. I mean, if you are a horror aficionado, it is definitely worth a watch. I think this is actually his first big breakout movie. And, well, he plays, like, Henry, the serial killer, the titular role. And he is just absolutely, like, disturbing in this. And also just the, I forget the co-star's name. Yeah, him and then the lead actress. They basically, it's just about... you know, some outcast from society, and, you know, Michael Rooker is, you know, a serial killer, and he gets his buddy into it, and it's, like, very visceral, and doesn't really pull any punches. It has this really, it's a disturbing movie, yeah, but, yeah, you know, he's definitely another one of those actors on this cast that just, he's got a quite of, you know, a resume.
Well, we should make it part of 2023.
Yeah, that'd be a good one to put in, and it's that's another one that you won't forget.
All right, so what's your first good?
My first good is, I think this has a, I'd say, you know, all around, I mean, I guess I'd say the cast is pretty decent on this. I did like, you know, Tony Goldwyn, I think, is a central villain. I thought he was pretty good in his role there. He does kind of make a transition pretty well from coming off as deceptively comforting at first, you know? I mean, the game, I guess the movie does give you some hints already that he's an asshole just from his entry into the building when he's at the security check. But, you know, I think he toes that line pretty well. And then his slow, you know, revelation of his true nature as the movie escalates is pretty well executed.
Yeah, he does seem like a man who's truly governed to protect his workers until it becomes clear that protection is not an option. There is only room for one person to survive, and he will be that survivor.
I guess if you kind of want to put some Freudian stuff on it, he first seems like there's some benevolence when he's operating kind of on the superego, but when he's more backed into a corner, more duress, kind of resolves into a more id type fixation of just pure survival, you know? So there's a kind of understandability to the character, but you know, you're already kind of primed of like, okay, yeah, he'll have some concern only to the extent that it's convenient, you know?
He wants the maximum amount of people to survive that is viable in the scenario. And if that's all of them, he will fight for all of them. But if it comes down to them or him, he will choose him all the time.
He's the man of action, as they say, you know, as they wrote about in 1984, you know, he's going to instantly make those. Well, you know, he's going to be appealing because he's the guy that can make those tough calls, you know. don't be lured in by these people.
Yeah. When someone says they can make the tough calls, it means that they will fucking murder you in an instant
if
the wind blows in that
direction. You know what? It's like, to go off on a tangent, it's like, well, not much of a tangent, but it's like, it's all those fucking people when Walking Dead was first airing, all those people that were like, oh, I'm a fan of Shane. Like, no, Shane is a fucking murderous prick, all right? Like, oh, no, Shane should be leading the group, not
Rick. Shane is not strong. He is the weakness that led to the world getting that bad in the first place.
Yeah, it was one of those things that, like, it got into, like certain people I had this sort of debate with when that show was out. It got kind of ideological in some ways just because, you know, it does get a little philosophical when it comes about, like, what was good leadership and, you know, and what is just the kind of thing that's going to lead to everybody essentially, you know, breaking the group cohesion.
Yeah, although, like, it does add, like, a bit of complexity to it because he is all those terrible things.
Yeah.
And he doesn't know how to let go when he finds out his friend is alive and, you know, his wife wants him back instead of him.
Right, yeah.
He can't handle that. But at least, like, before the situation got that bad, in an ideal situation, he was a better friend. Mm-hmm. Like, when the outbreak first happened, he actually barred the door to Rick's room to protect him while he was still in a coma from the gunshot that he had received before the outbreak.
Yes.
So, in an ideal world, he does look out for his friends. He does look out for the people. But he was definitely like this boss. The second things stop being ideal, it's like they can just code switch into a total self-survival mode.
Yeah.
Which is interesting because some people, like as we've seen in like the news and in politics, some people just seem to live in survivor mode all the fucking time.
Yeah.
And they just they unapologetically exude this selfishness.
Well, yeah, if you create an environment that incentivizes a dog-eat-dog type of mentality, I think, for some people, it can just activate something. And there's people that kind of thrive in that, you know?
Yeah.
But, but it's like they thrive at the expense of others.
Oh, yeah, like the psychological aspects of this movie are great because it comes down to the survival at any cost. The hawk versus the dove.
Yes.
Because Mike in this movie is a pacifist. He always advocates for humans to embrace their better nature, that, you know, we survive together rather than surviving together beats dying alone.
Yes.
Like, what's the point of being the last person alive if you lose everything? And how he holds on to his ideals until he has no choice but to let them go.
Sure. I mean, it breaks it down to the point where it gets down to, it's just an animalistic thing where it's basically kill or be killed, you know?
It comes to the point where they are killing.
Well, there's no one left to save, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's at this not point. An option.
Yeah.
But it all depends on... It's not about who will you seek peace for, but rather who will you kill for? Mm-hmm. And the boss kills for himself, while Michael, as soon as he has to abandon his pacifism, takes up a different nobility, in that he kills for others.
Yes.
If not to save their life, then to avenge their death.
Right. It's like,
so again, serving one is killing
some sort of primal justice. You know?
Yeah, one kills for selfishness and the other kills, if he can't protect the group, then he will carry the memory of the group in their heart and make sure everyone responsible for the death of the group suffers. Like,
yes,
he's still a collectivist in his heart. If he can't protect everyone, he will avenge everyone.
Yeah. So it's like, you know, at that point, it's the least you could do, and to still be in line with, I think, his, you know, his axioms, his own personal axioms. I feel like he still stays true to his character for sure throughout the movie.
Yeah, he...
Mr. Mike here, yeah.
He has to... It's like he doesn't abandon his principles. He just abandons how he adheres to his principles.
Yeah. All while dressed like a guy in like a T-Mobile store from like the early 2000s. Yeah, I love his costume. Like, they did the whole Office Space short sleeve thing, you know? He's like the middle management guy. He has some pull, but yeah, he's not like upper management. Anyways, I guess that was like, we went off on a tangent on my good there. What was your next one?
My second good, because... You know, I was worried that we weren't going to be, that we just didn't have too much to say about this movie, because there's a lot, this is an enjoyable movie, but very little to dwell on.
Yeah, I think what it is, I don't have a ton of bullet points, but at least some of these are ones, you know, they do stimulate some interesting conversation, because this movie does deal with some themes that are, I think, interesting that you can talk about a lot.
I mean, that almost happens with a lot of gun movies.
Mm-hmm.
Like, when you watch them, there's plenty of amazing themes, like Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah.
You think it's like, oh, it's like a space comic book movie, but no, it's about family. The family that you leave, the family you leave behind, and the family you find.
Yeah. Yeah, very much so. It's like, it's using this as a backdrop to tell what is kind of an intimate story, you know? Yeah,
and then Guardians of the Galaxy 2, it delves deeper.
Into fatherhood. Kind of expands upon that theme, like family and stuff. Just kind of zooms in on that, you know?
Yeah, the father that you have by blood, the father that you have through life.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, with Baby Groot, like, the father you become.
Yeah.
Because, like, he ends up, like, having arguments with Baby Groot. Like, hey, you're leaving sap all over the place. Clean your room. And
yeah, I got to be honest, man. I miss Big Groot. I don't know. I don't like Baby Groot as much as Big Groot.
Yeah, well, I mean, he is kind of growing seemingly quickly. So hopefully we'll get back to regular size
Groot. Let's get set back to regular size Groot. I want Vin Diesel back as Groot.
God, that was not Vin Diesel on a pitch modulator.
Yeah, right. That was that's just a fun, delightful, fun fact.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I didn't like about the Guardians movie, at least in the way they handled Groot, was when they were when Rocket was saying his species doesn't talk much, so he has a small vocabulary.
Mm-hmm.
In the comics, it's portrayed much better, where he it always sounds like he's just saying, "I am Groot," but it's the subtle intonations of each syllable and sound that portray he is saying like full on sentences in his language.
Yeah.
He's conveying full thoughts in his language. And there was like one issue where he's talking to Kitty Pryde of the X-Men.
Yeah.
And somehow like he has like a some sort of translator or some psychic connection to her. And well, he says, "I am Groot." In the translation, it shows like a full on like panel saying like, "Kitty, in you, I see the hope of your species. I see many humans in my life, and I just wanted to walk among you, to be like you, to see the world as you do." And it's just like a beautiful, like almost like a fucking poem in like the thoughts being conveyed, but the words come out as, "I am Groot."
Yeah.
And then in the movie, they just portray him as a dum-dum who can only speak.
Hodor. Who can
only speak three words.
Right.
So that I thought was like I wouldn't say it was like a bad turn, but less than ideal turn.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we haven't got to my second good yet.
Yeah, what is this good?
My second good is Mike stepping up with the by using the gun on the acetylene tank just to stick it to his boss. When he's trying to use the blowtorch to get to the guns.
It was a good, clever way of, like, you know, I loved that how he sort of diffused that scene, you know?
With his pacifism.
Exactly, you know. Evan over there was, like, you know, sitting there holding a gun, kind of nervous. Like, he was going to institute violence, and he, you know, kind of sidestepped that, you know? He got the gun there from Evan, and, you know.
Yeah. Although, in hindsight, definitely should have let Evan take out the upper management.
Yeah. It's like, you know, you could say later on down the road, it might have just been good to get rid of these people.
Yeah.
It's like, I feel you, Mike, but I also see that there's some clear objective threats that are going to become very problematic if we don't weed them out right now. Like,
although we say that, but given the situation that the overseers were never going to let anybody but one person survive in the first place. As much as you'd say, like, yeah, these guys definitely were assholes and they embraced their roles a little too well, it was still going to come down to everyone slaughtering each other.
Well, if they've been planning it this long, then they probably have thought about every conceivable way that people would try to escape. So, yeah, very true. I guess that's the whole point of this, like, experiment.
There is no good way. There is no good way
out. Yeah, I mean, it's just designed to, you know, and it's like they're not trying to get any sort of specific outcome. They're like, if we end up killing you all, that's fine, you know? Or, you know, or if one of you guys ends up persisting through it. Like, hey, it's just about data, right?
So, what is your next good?
I'd say I did also enjoy our protagonist. I guess, you know, we talked already a little bit about Mike on this, so I won't say add too much more to it, but I enjoyed him, his just sense of, like, really, like, wanting to protect people. Like, I admire that, though, you know, his moxie, and, you know, and maybe there was times where it's, like, it wasn't always the right way to go about things. I think it's important to have that influence in that kind of situation, you know? Like, having everybody, it's like not having ideals in the world. It's like, what are we striving towards, you know? It's like, that's how, like, we end up kind of turning into monsters if we don't have that sort of, that balancing there. So, I don't know. I enjoyed his contributions to this movie, even though something about his costuming in this, well, you know, his attire was a little distracting. I just kept saying, like, God, yeah, he looks like he should be selling, like, fucking, he should be in one of those Netscape Navigator commercials from, like, the early 2000s. Like, but, no, he was pretty good in this. John Gallagher Jr., you know, he's good. He was a likable protagonist, so.
The last browser standing on your computer should be Netscape Navigator.
Yeah. So, I mean, because they're saying, like, it's, like, referencing Office Space. And it's, like, yeah, the dress style is very much, like, late 90s, early 2000s. Like, reminds me of, like, just that old office worker. And well, I guess he seems to have a bit more sway in the office than what he looks like he is, you know? It seemed like he, like, managed a floor or something.
My next good is James Gunn knows how to pick a soundtrack to a death scene.
Yeah, doesn't he?
I mean, California Dreaming in Spanish during the execution / riot.
Right. Brilliant.
It was just brilliant cinematic shit.
Yeah, and it's it just makes it for like a thrill ride, you know?
And then he always like, the way he ties in the music with the kills,
like the
in Slither,
yeah.
It's when they're playing like Every Woman in the World to Me, they're actually playing it on a record player, and mm-hmm. in this, they're actually playing the song on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the song is happening in the world.
Yeah,
diegetic. That's what it is.
Yeah,
it's diegetic music.
That music they were playing whenever, like, they're just, like, executing all the people in that room, like, burying all them. They're just playing that Spanish music on the radio.
Yeah. Even in Guardians 2.
Yeah.
With Come a Little Bit Closer while Michael Rooker is murdering a space station.
Right.
I like the way they tie that in, like, they're playing it over the loudspeakers.
Yeah. I guess one thing I gotta honor, this was something I was gonna bring up as just far as maybe like my kill of the week, but just now that you're bringing it up about like use of music, well, this is not so much music, but it's a little more the soundtrack. But when I guess Mike is killing Barry, when he's hitting him over the head, and it's like doing that just old corporate motivational speech, like, you know, here at Belco, we want to reach the highest human potential and shit. Yeah. Like, just it was very well synced up with that whole scene, you know.
Oh, even like
it's the, just oh, I was just bashed my head in with fucking
the lighting
tape
like
holder,
slow motion as he's like raising up the tape dispenser,
yeah,
just bringing it down on the guy's head repeatedly,
right?
It's just
caved his head in. Oh, you know, I think there's a running theme in this movie. It's just this movie is all about fucking head trauma. Like, think about it, like almost it's like every kill in this movie has almost all been fucking head trauma. Like,
80%. Yeah, because these people have trackers in their heads.
They have trackers in their heads, but there's like so many, like, you know.
The axe.
The axe to the face.
When the scrubs pervert gets the fucking axe.
Michael Rooker gets hit on the head with the fucking club, you know.
Polka Dot Man gets skewered on rebar. Like, what the fuck was that movie with the...
Oh, yeah, he got set. Yeah, I was like, I remember he got killed, like, through some sort of head trauma.
What was it, Very Bad Things or something?
Not sure.
Yeah, there was a movie where like four guys, I think, were going to Vegas, mm-hmm. and one of the Jeremy Piven, I think, he's hooking up with a girl in the bathroom, and then like he accidentally like he goes to pin her against the wall, and her neck gets pierced in the back by the coat hanger.
Mm-hmm.
So that like kills her instantly, and they end up burying her in the desert. Huh. It was called Very Bad Things.
Okay.
Polka Dot Man gets the Very Bad Things treatment.
Yeah. Okay.
when he gets pushed into a wall and a piece of rebar pierces his skull.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. That was a kill in Halloween 6, I think, as well.
Yeah, and then the boss, when his assistant tries to seduce him in order to spare her life. And you think he's going to fall for it for a minute, but then he just gets up closer and says, "Can't waste a bullet." And he snaps her fucking neck like a goddamn villain.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he was great. Like I said, he was a great villain. He was fucking just... He definitely turned into just absolute filth. You wanted to see him die. And then, and his lackey there, John C. McGinley, you know, always great, you know, as just the obnoxious asshole. Wendell Dukes. I love, like, just the whole scene where he's like, you know, where it's like, it's all about the highest body count. He's like, oh, I might be able to beat him, you know? Yeah. And then he gets taken out in a very satisfying and gruesome way. So guess, yeah, I was going to say, like, for my second good, I just had to say, like, yeah, this has so many great, like, kills, great effects with, like, the blood splatter and everything. I mean, it's a James Gunn movie. It's got that kind of mark to it. And, yeah, I guess I had to say, I was like, I think a running theme of this movie, I don't know, it was just a fuckload of head trauma. Just, I mean, they already have it as a plot device because it's the stuff implanted in everybody's brain. But a lot of just kills, people getting shot in the head, fucking head smashed with an axe, head smashed with a tape dispenser, even some other ones I can't even remember now. But I don't know, it's just great if you like, you know, hey man, if you want to see some, you know, blood and guts and violence, man, it delivers that, and it's entertaining, I think, to piggyback on your good about, like, the use of the soundtrack and all that. Just, yeah, it just makes every scene hit that much better. Har, har, har.
Yeah. And I dumped all my goods in there because the rest of my goods were just, like, excellent kills.
Yeah, I'm trying to see if I have anything else really I could say on this. Yeah, not really. I mean, it's kind of like just it's. I think it's all around. It's a fun concept. I kind of like these sort of social experiment movies, though. You know, I at least give it some praise there.
So, now we can get to the bads. And this is all going to be on you because I don't have any bads. I didn't see a single thing in this movie where I thought, nah, I don't care for that.
Yeah, gotcha. I think there's just some stuff where, you know, a lot of storylines didn't really go anywhere. And they seem to show a lot of it without it. Like Melanie Diaz's character, Danny, or, you know, I don't know, she got killed off pretty abruptly when it seemed like there was going to be more things that happened with her. So I was kind of like, okay, what was the whole point of that? Maybe it's just like, you know, trying to be a little subversive and play with your expectations. I kind of thought like this, the payoff, I felt like just maybe the overall plot when we meet the voice and they're explaining all this stuff, it feels so just kind of tacked on. Like, I felt like maybe they just could have developed this a little bit more, like why they're doing all this. It's like, oh, we just want to study human behavior, but I didn't feel like this was explored enough. I don't know.
This definitely should have got a sequel to elaborate on it.
Yeah. It felt a little, I guess it's just some parts of it felt a little thin. I mean, I'm kind of, it's hard to explain, but maybe a little more. I was hoping for a little bit more just before it got right to Greg Henry dying, you know, who played the voice. And then I would have liked some explanation with just where he had highly all the scarring on his face.
A lot does not get explained, which should.
Yeah, exactly. I guess I was.
Did this company. Is this a terrorist group that, you know, infiltrated, like, took a strike against Belko? Has it been Belko all along?
Right. Like, I felt like there was, it kind of didn't really give me enough information to feed my imagination before it kind of just, at some point while I was entertained, I felt like the movie kind of just digressed into a splatterfest. And it kind of lost some of its narrative complexity, I guess. And I was hoping for something a little bit more because it did have an intriguing plot. I would have liked to be explored a little bit more, just given us some more nuggets of lore and intrigue, I guess.
Gunn seems to put even a lot more thought into other stuff.
Yeah.
It seemed like one of like an afterthought. Like, right. Kind of dreamed up a bit, scribbled some shit down, and then I just, like, do the concept.
Yeah.
Like, I've got a divorce going on. And
To compare this with a similar movie, because they say this Office Space meets Battle Royale. Battle Royale has kind of a similar idea, you know, with, well, it's a bunch of, like, I don't know if you've seen Battle Royale before, but it's,
I haven't yet.
Oh, excellent movie, too.
Do you think that would be a good candidate for this?
Possibly. It's hard to really call it a horror movie, but it's definitely
forced to be. Horror it's pretty a nebulous term. Like,
it's horrifying. So, yeah, you could loosely put it in there.
I mean, this is hardly a horror movie. Like, there's no monster. Like, what makes a horror movie? Is it monsters or is it, like, exploring the human condition?
Yeah, and this is much more of that.
Possibilities towards brutality. If it's not a slasher or a creature, it's about man versus man.
Yeah, it's definitely a thriller. That's for sure. And so I think a lot of thriller movies you could lump into, you could review it within a horror context.
Like Silence of the Lambs. It's really a horror movie.
Seven.
It's definitely a thriller.
Yeah. Like Seven is like a thriller, but it's a very dark thriller to the point where you could definitely call that a horror movie in some respects.
Horrors and thrillers are so nebulous. I always, at least in my interpretation.
Yeah.
A thriller is like a subgenre of horror that does not deal with the supernatural.
Yeah. And it's generally, there's a lot of like police procedurals are a common trope in a lot of thrillers. Like you don't get that as much with horror movies, like dwelling so much on like procedural dramas, you know, talk about like, yeah, you get lower, sometimes more of the police work and stuff involved. That's kind of like one distinction I see with a lot of thrillers, what you call a suspense thriller. But anyways, yeah, the Battle Royale, though, does do a lot of exploration on, like, the architects of this death games that they made for these high school students at this. They were all in the same class at this high school. And I guess they got picked to be in this death game that's on this island. That's basically the basic plot. But you do go into a bit of backstory on, yeah, the people who made this and the motivations behind this and... There's just a lot of layers of complexity outside of just the individual characters. And I did feel like some of the characters weren't explored all that much. It was more in favor to kind of set up the action parts, which is fine. But, I think with a plot like this, I want to see more of that. Like, because it does get in very much into that realm of... abstract ideas and makes me think a lot of like Foucault and like Durkheim and a lot of that like social sciences and social psychology.
Oh, like the Sanford experiment and.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
what was that experiment in like the 60s where they were just like
the prison experiment?
The what?
Is that the one you're talking about where it was like the.
Well, the Sanford experiment was the one where they had like a. Half the students were prisoners and the other half were
the Sanford prison experiment.
There was also another one where they just had people do things and to see who would do it because of it was ordered by an authority figure, like the torture test.
The shock experiments, like where they they would tell the person that they're administering a shock and whenever they turn the knobs, the person would act like they're getting shocked to try to... And then they just keep telling them, like, you have to do this to see... What people would do if they're under duress like that, so...
Yeah, if people hear something from an authority figure...
Yeah.
How many people are willing to just follow orders to commit violence against other people?
Right.
Simply because it's not their decision, they're just enacting someone else's will.
Yeah.
And somehow absolving themselves of personal responsibility.
Exactly. It was kind of like a study, I think, branched off a lot from... what's her name? Who wrote The Banality of Evil. So... Kind of looking at that, you know, just how people can fall into these patterns when following an authority figure and, you know, can be kind of coerced, like, subconsciously, non-verbally, into doing some pretty heinous things, you know? So, I digress, but I guess I'm kind of just lumping this into a broad bad, you know, just there were, it was a little thinly layered for me, I guess you'd say. And I would have liked Michael Rooker to stay alive a little bit longer because I like Michael Rooker.
Yeah. Michael Rooker definitely should have died in a face off as the boss.
And you know what? And he was a nice guy too, but you know, I guess he's the kind of person that's going to get killed early. Poor old Lonnie just couldn't hack it and just goes crazy and hits him on accident. Hey, and you know, that was a cool effect too, though. That I will say that as like a mini good there. Just the part with it, just showing, like, the dent in his head, you know? Like, it's like,
damn. And so he's like, what?
Honestly, it was it felt kind of believable because he's like sort of like, you know, he's had this head trauma. He just like doesn't quite know what's going on.
I just felt like if James Gunn had time to direct this movie, he may have gone like a bit more cartoony with it, and he definitely would have seen like birds flying around his head.
Right. I feel like this movie, I mean, it's only like, what, an hour and a half runtime. I would have been fine with this movie being like 30 minutes longer to add some more plot development, or just add a little, I want to find out a little bit more about the people who put this on, because they built this up, they showed a lot of it, they built so much mystery on it that I felt the payoff. So another thing, it's just the payoff was a little bit.
Yeah, the movie has like a monitor with.
It is cool. I'm glad he gets his comeuppance, but I would have liked that to be more drawn out than it was.
For some reason, we see the monitors. They're showing other Belko experiments where people are leaving the doors.
And that's left just really
various. It's various people, like various archetypes. Like, we got one guy who's just like scribbled in blood, "Forgive me," on the door.
Yeah, and there's some part of the zombie in it. And like, I don't know what the fuck.
One guy's just like looking at the camera with his face covered in blood while laughing like Bruce Campbell in Evil Dead.
I didn't feel like that was very. I get what they were trying to do. It was kind of cool. It had this cabin in the woods feel to it. But I wish. Again, they didn't really provide a lot of context. I didn't really understand that shot at first. So I was like, oh, okay, he's going back to the monitors. But I was just kind of like...
And then, like, one lady comes out, like, fucking Lara Croft with, like, dual Uzis.
Yeah, very Joss Whedon right there.
I'm just like, what the fuck am I... what the fuck am I looking at? Like, you're just creating an army of psychopaths.
Yeah, this is just... I think you're right there. I think this movie... needs a sequel. I'd like to see a sequel to round this out a little bit more.
Unite the survivors where they make find each other and wage war against
the
corporation.
For sure. And they could easily like start it off like early in the movie, have a little bit of exposition talking about the first movie and talking a little bit more about Belko and just who these guys are. I mean, I guess I get it. Like, they're trying to do the social research, but it just didn't feel like there was enough there. Like, why are they really doing this? Like, okay, yeah, we want data, but, like, what's really your goal here? Like, but I don't know. There is some good food for thought out of this. So, I don't know. With me saying this, don't get me wrong, I think this is a pretty damn fun movie. It's worth a watch.
Yeah, so now we can take it to the kill of the week.
Yes, sir.
And I'm going to say, I like how Mike gets the last laugh on The Voice and his goons.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's a good setup, too. They set it up pretty well earlier with the...
They prefaced it with James Gunn's brother.
Like, right.
God, all the bombs were going to blow the door.
Yeah.
A better idea comes along.
I guess I didn't comment it, so I probably didn't talk about him enough there when the goods, but he was actually enjoyable. I just like how he's freaking out about the fucking water jugs and shit. And
he's like, the water is the problem, so he's just like, let's get everyone dehydrated during water.
Yeah, the funny and just like, of everyone's head exploding. He's like, it's all in my head. It's all in my head. I love the language there, so I'm kind of tacking that on there at the end. I was like, his character was funny.
Oh, how you're so fucking mellow just getting stoned on the roof.
Yeah, it's like, he's like, it's literally, they could do whatever the fuck they want with us. It's just like every time he just eats his words, you know?
He's like, listen, man, this is all just like it's all just a fucking prank, man. It's all in your head. And then the girl next to him has her head explode.
Yeah, it's perfect.
And then, funny enough, he gets shot. Like, he keeps saying, it's in my head, it's in my head. And
yeah,
you think that's when he's going to get randomly blown up, but no, he gets shot in the head.
Yeah.
Soon after.
There we go. It's another headshot. It's like James Gunn, man. He loves those head splatters.
and the fact that, like, it's like the closest thing to justice that happens in this movie where the, I wouldn't say the architects, but the right hand. Or like the close, I mean, henchmen, like everyone's a henchman in this scene. Like, we don't know who the boss is.
Yeah.
But the lead henchman and the sub henchman, get fucking blown to kingdom come.
Oh, yeah, they do. I guess you could say, like, I don't know, all of a sudden Mike, I guess, knows how to handle all these fucking, like, assault rifles, you know? Like,
well, he only needs the assault rifle to use on one guy because
yeah.
he used the bombs on everyone else.
Right.
And the one guy he did use the gun on, it's not like it was like an epic gun battle.
Oh, sure. I mean, the guy was pretty close.
He could figure it out.
I submit it. I did kind of reason that my way out of that one, though. I'm like, yeah, I mean, the guy's pretty close. You got a holster right there. You don't really need to be, like, a great shot to make that, you know?
These guys aren't going to have the safety on their gun. That would have jammed them up. But
right.
These people had their guns ready to murder anyone trying to escape. So
yeah, exactly.
Safeties are not on.
It's like, just hold it on there a little bit, just not to, like, drop the gun from, like, the recoil or some shit, you know?
I mean, that would have been fucking hilarious. He fires the gun and then, like, he yeah. drops it and he starts nursing his chest because he cracked a rib on the recoil.
Exactly. The recoil just, like, fucking dislocated his shoulder or something, like... And he has to do a diehard thing, like he's putting it back into his socket, like, ah!
he has to run headfirst into a corner.
Right.
Just to, like, lodge his shoulder back in.
Yeah. Ah! That could be, like, a funny sequence right there.
Even better, he doesn't know how to do it, so he's just trying to imitate what he's seen on TV. And
he thinks.
He keeps making it worse.
Exactly. It's like, It's like he'd be like the guy from, like, Hot Fuzz, you know? He's just like, everything he knows is just from watching action movies.
So he tries to, like, put his hand on the table and hold it in one arm and, like, push down. And it just, like, right. crunches worse and it starts turning purple. And
yeah.
That would be great. It'll everyone he kills and he ends up killing himself trying to relocate his shoulder.
Yeah.
But sounds using like, bad TV information right. that he's barely remembered over 10 or 15 years.
It has the same tone as, like, the last, like, sequence of, like, you know, Pineapple Express, when they're all, like, just in the shootout and stuff, and it's like Seth Rogen gets a piece of his ear shot off, and he's like, oh, man, that's fucking gross. He's like, wow, man, does it look kind of like badass? And he's like, no, it doesn't.
That movie is really fucking fun. I saw that twice in theaters. I just enjoyed the fuck out of it.
Yeah, it's hard to believe, man. It's like already over, like, God, it's almost 15 years old now. Shit.
Yeah, good back one. When James Franco was still hireable.
Yeah, oh my God, no, before he just got completely canceled in my mind, so. Yep, we lost another one. Oh, man.
We were
a kill of the week. I did already kind of spoil it, but I think just the final kill on Barry there with the corporate motivational empty speech playing on in the background is thematically awesome, and yeah, it just looks really great. Just like it's that thing just lodges into his brain.
Just crunch.
Yeah.
And the way it's shot, like, even, like, from behind where it's just Mike's silhouette holding the fucking tape dispenser in shadow.
Yeah.
While the flickering of the projector is illuminating him. Mm-hmm. It's almost like he's being reborn.
Yeah,
Like, the pacifist is dead. The warrior is born in blood.
Reach his highest potential. We do believe in human development and some shit.
Yeah,
like
Belko has unleashed his highest human potential.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's just there's a lot of.
It really is like a fucking great scene.
I love it. There's a lot of like visual communication going on there. Like this, there's a lot of the subtext in there. It's a great scene. So.
Yeah, he's a man who has given in to anger and violence and has to accept. We can't change that we are a violent species, but we can change what we are violent for.
This scene was Office Space if the fax machine was a person, all right? Yeah, if we swapped it out for a person.
Lumberg was the printer.
It's like that tension, because even if you look at the cover of the movie, it's him doing that shit right there. So it's like, yeah, it's we just swap in Bill Lumberg right there.
Yeah, if Lumberg was the printer, boom.
Yeah, hi. Bill Lumberg here.
Die, motherfucker, die, motherfucker still. Just walks out of the hangar. Dang, it feels good to be a gangster.
Ava feels good to be a gangster.
So, you know, I just had a fucking great time with this. I guess I wasn't in, like, the headspace to, like, think about things, but it did have, like, a lot. It was thin. Like, this was definitely, I guess because Gunn wasn't directing it. He only wrote it and, like, just threw money at it.
Yeah.
So, it was kind of like Gunn light rather than, you know, a typical Gunn-directed movie like Slither. That was a fucking 5 out of 5. Guardians, 5 out of 5.
I think Suicide it lacks, Squad,
5 out of 5. I've yet to see a James Gunn movie that he directed that was not immaculate. Yeah, when he gives his full attention to something.
Right. I think that's, yeah, that's a big
it's
thing.
It's masterful.
To keep in mind is he didn't actually direct this. He wrote it, but yeah, because there was something that did seem to lack a little bit of his touch to it, because I know James Gunn, you know, as like writing and directing can, you know, make a really entertaining movie that also, you know, has some, it's layered. I mean, you know, even talk about with Guardians of the Galaxy, it's deeply themed while also being a fun action adventure movie, you know?
Yeah, he knows how to keep themes.
Yeah.
Like, even in Suicide Squad, like, the themes was, like, you know, people made to do violence who have lived lives in violence, finding a purpose among each other, and, you know, just making the call to become better people.
Like, yes.
People tired of being who they are. And wanting to be better and finding, again, family.
Yeah.
Like, that's another theme. Like, they find family in each other, and they even decide to, like, risk dying to help strangers. Like,
yeah.
They decide, like, we've lived as villains, but we don't have to be villains.
Yeah. You don't have to, you know,
you
don't
always
have
a choice.
Yeah.
Even if that choice looks like it's going to kill you,
mm-hmm.
You still have that choice.
Sure. You know, it's like, yeah, you don't have to let that define you, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, even Harley Quinn, when she kills the guy, she's just like, listen, you're definitely my type, but my type is bad for me. And you're putting out some major fucking red flags. So RIP to that monster dick.
Larp. Law.
Because, you know, he's got to have, like, you know, it's kind of like Big Mouth, where you're, like, there is, like, a truth to the human experience, but you got to throw vulgarity in there because, you know, life is vulgar.
Yeah, well, exactly. It is true to life, you know. Hey, you know, so, home is where you make it, all right?
Yeah. So, my rating, despite the fact that this is still Gunn light, it's still a Gunn movie, I'm giving this 5 tape dispensers to the skull out of 5.
Excellent.
It was less Gunn than we usually get, but still, even half-assed James Gunn is still a fucking comedic, gruesome thrill ride.
Yeah.
It was just good Gunn goodness.
Yeah, I'm right.
So what was your rating?
All right. I will give this one, let's see. I'm trying to think of like a good description. But all right, 3 poison water jugs. Out of 5, or supposedly poison water jugs out of 5. So I think this is a really fun, well shot movie. It's got some great action sequences. Maybe, like, for me, who's like into like heady social experiment type movies, maybe it was lacking a little bit in the storyline department, but you know, I don't really hold that against this movie too much. I think it's definitely one I'm going to rewatch, and now that I've seen it once and I have my expectations properly catered, my rating might go up on this one. It's definitely a very fun movie. I would definitely recommend.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a bloody mess. It's awesome. A bloody mess in the best kind of way. So.
Yeah. It's definitely, it's definitely worth a watch if you haven't seen it. And if you have seen it, well, maybe watch it again.
Yeah.
So that's it for this month. Next month, we will be doing the Chris Massacre on the Graveyard Ship. We're going to be back on some holiday horrors.
Jingle, jangle.
And we're going to see who we're going to be going on a sleigh ride with as I try to wrangle up some guests. And hopefully we'll be stuffing your podcast stockings with some beautiful shiny diamonds and not lumps of coal. But we'll see what we'll see what the movies provide.
Right. Maybe some candy canes.
But until next time, I'm Mike.
And I'm John.
And thank you very much for joining us on The Graveyard Shift.
The Graveyard Shift is a Strange Biscuits production. Visit our website at strangebiscuits.com/graveyardshift to hear all of our previous episodes. Subscribe to us, rate, and review us on CastBox, Apple Podcast, Stitcher, and Spotify. And don't forget to check out our Instagram at The Graveyard Shift Pod, as well as our Facebook at The Graveyard Shift Pod. Our Twitter is GS_HorrorPod, and if you wish to support the show financially, visit us at patreon.com/graveyard. For as little as $1 a month, you can help support the show and get bonus content. The theme for The Graveyard Shift is As Brutal As It Ever Was by TechnoAxe. Visit their website at technoaxe.com and their YouTube channel for more royalty-free music. Thank you for listening, and as always, stay spooky.